Chapter 18, Discovering Dharmapala. Devapriya Valasinha and I did not know each other very well. We had met briefly in Gangtok, and, I think, in Calcutta, and had spent some time together in Kathmandu, but the acquaintance had not really developed. Apart from the difference in our ages, he was nearly twice as old as I was, there was the fact that, whereas I was a monk, he was very much the Theravada layman. More important still, though General Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society, he was of a somewhat shy and retiring, not to say nervous disposition, and did not make friends either very quickly or very easily. He was, however, an excellent correspondent, and ever since our exchange of letters concerning the bringing of the sacred relics to Kalimpong, we had been writing to each other from time to time on topics of common Buddhist interest. Only a few months earlier, after the collapse of Stepping Stones, he had written expressing his regret that I was unable to continue bringing out the magazine, but remarking, at the same time, that it was not easy to propagate the Dharma in India, and that, rather than trying to work on my own, I would perhaps be better advised to join forces with an established Buddhist organisation. Now, towards the end of the rainy season, came a letter inviting me to come down to Calcutta and write a biographical sketch of Anagarika Dharmapala for inclusion in the Mahabodhi Society's Diamond Jubilee souvenir. Valasinha wrote, "The society, having been founded in 1891, they should really have brought out the souvenir the previous year, but there had been the usual delays, and in the end it had been decided to bring it out this year instead, at the end of November, when the sacred relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Maha Modgalyayana would be re-enshrined at Sanchi, and the newly constructed Sanchi Vihara opened. Perhaps it would also be possible for me to accompany the sacred relics to Sanchi, just as I had accompanied them to Kathmandu." Though I knew little more about Dharmapala than that he was the founder of the Mahabodhi Society, and that for years he had sought to wrest the Mahabodhi Temple at Buddha Gaya, where the Buddha had attained enlightenment, from the clutches of the mercenary Hindu Mahant, Valasinha's proposal appealed to me strongly. Since the demise of Stepping Stones, I had written little more than an article and a couple of short stories, and welcomed the opportunity of putting my energies into a new literary project, as well as of getting to know Valasinha himself better. I therefore wrote to the shy and retiring General Secretary, accepting his invitation, and promising to come down as soon as I could. Thus it was that at the beginning of September I left Kalimpong for Calcutta for the third time since my arrival in the township with Kashyapji 2.5 years earlier. Though the rains had abated, landslides were still blocking the road between Teesta Bridge and the plains, so that my fellow passengers and I had to transship 3 or 4 times and scramble, sometimes ankle deep in mud, over enormous piles of rock and earth, as well as over the trunks of uprooted trees. From Siliguri to Calcutta, the journey was uneventful, except for the late afternoon crossing by paddle boat from one sandy shore of the Ganges to the other. And by mid-morning the following day, I found myself amid the clamour and bustle of Sealdah Station. Though 5 years had passed since partition, thousands of refugees from East Bengal were still encamped around the station area. Huts had sprung up, and from many of the huts flew the red hammer and sickle flag of the Communist Party. Extricating myself from the swarms of hawkers and beggars, I hailed an antiquated hackney carriage. On principle, I tried to avoid using rickshaws, directed the ancient driver to take me to College Square, and 15 or 20 minutes later was alighting in front of the pink sandstone Ajanta-style façade of the Sri Dharmarajika Vihara, was haggling over the fare, was being humbly saluted by the Durwan or doorkeeper, was being conducted along the narrow passage that ran down the side of the Vihara and gave direct access to the Society's headquarters at the rear. Within half an hour of my arrival, I had been welcomed by Devapriya Valasinha, given tea and toast, and settled in a corner room on the second floor, immediately behind the Vihara and at the opposite end of the veranda from Devapriyaji's own quarters. It was not, of course, the first time that I had stayed at the headquarters of the Mahabodhi Society. Apart from the night or two that I had sometimes spent there in more recent years on my way to or from Sarnath or Kathmandu, I had stayed there for a month or more in 1947, when I was still a layman, so that I was quite familiar with the place. Unlike Sri Dhammarajika Vihara, it had no architectural pretensions whatever, and was built round the three sides of a small square, one of the sides on all three floors being occupied by Indian-style bathrooms and toilets. Below me on the first floor were the library, the sitting room where important visitors were received, and the rooms reserved for students and resident monks, the most prominent among the latter being the high priest, as Jinnaratana liked to style himself. At the time of my original stay, it had been His Holiness the High Priest, I recalled. On the ground floor were the general office, where an accountant and two or three clerks were employed, and where Devapriyaji did some of his work. The dark and insalubrious kitchen and dining room, and the cheerless apartments in which pilgrims on their way to or from Buddha Gaya and the other holy places were allowed to put up for not more than 3 nights. On the same floor as my own room, and on the same side of the building, were 4 more rooms for students and monks, the last 3 of which gave off from the veranda that ran round the 3 closed sides of the square. Above me was the flat roof of the building, on which it had long been proposed to construct another story. Yet though the place was familiar to me, and though outwardly nothing had changed, I was at once conscious that a very different kind of atmosphere now prevailed. 5 years ago, the atmosphere had been one of stagnation and decay, even of downright corruption. But now things were moving. There was a sense of purpose in the air. And it seemed as though it might, after all, be possible to regard the headquarters of the Mahabodhi Society as a centre of Buddhism, which it certainly had not been in 1947, when Jinnaratana was in charge, and when I had shaken the dust of the place from my feet with feelings of disappointment and disgust. What, then, had happened? Was the fact that such a different atmosphere now prevailed due to the long-delayed return of Devapriyaji, who had been absent in Ceylon for some 5 or 6 years? Or was it due to the presence of the sacred relics, which in the intervals of their triumphant visits to different parts of India and Southeast Asia had been exposed for worship in the Sri Dhammarajika Vihara? Or was the difference due simply to the fact that there were now more people living in the place, more visitors coming, and more pilgrims passing through on their way to and from the holy places? I did not know. Possibly the difference was due not to any one of these factors singly, but to 2 or more of them in combination, or even to circumstances of which I was entirely ignorant. Or perhaps... But there was no time for speculation. The Diamond Jubilee souvenir had to be out by the end of November. Devapriyaji was keen that I should start work on the biographical sketch without delay. And before long we were sitting in his room with a pot of Ceylon tea on the desk between us, discussing the project. The room was hardly wider than the desk, which was so placed as to divide it into 2 unequal parts. Behind the desk, as though behind a barricade, and facing the door, sat Devapriyaji, while behind him, along the back wall of the room, could be seen the white-shrouded form of his bed, which was so lofty that it must have been difficult for him to observe the 8th precept on Poya days. short, plump, and bespectacled. The little General Secretary wore a long Bengali-style shirt and a voluminous Bengali-style dhoti or loincloth, both of immaculate whiteness. Though born and brought up in Ceylon, he had spent the greater part of his adult life in Calcutta, and it was often said of him that in appearance and personal habits, he was more like a Bengali than a Sinhalese. His features were certainly Bengali. Studying him as he did the honours of the teapot, I saw a face the colour of wheat tea, with a prominent, high-bridged nose, a small chin and weak mouth, a pair of sad brown eyes like those of an ill-used but faithful dog, and a lofty but narrow forehead, from which the hairline had receded to such an extent as to make him appear almost bald. When he smiled, the tea-coloured face lit up, and it was evident that as a young man, David Priyaji must have been more than ordinarily handsome. But he did not smile very often, his expression usually being one of either nervousness or diffidence. And observing him from the other side of the desk as we discussed the projected biographical sketch, I could not help recalling what Swale Ryan once told me about the circumstances that had led to his spending so long a period in Ceylon. In 1941, war had broken out with Japan, and on account of its close ties with the country, the Mahabodhi Society had fallen under the suspicion of the authorities. David Priyaji and Dr. Kalidas Nag, who was, I believe, the editor of the Mahabodhi Journal, were arrested and detained for 5 or 6 weeks. And during their detention, both men were rather roughly interrogated. As a result of this unpleasant experience, David Priyaji suffered a nervous breakdown and had to be sent to Ceylon for treatment. Despite all the care he received, it was several years before he could again lead a normal life, and even after his return to Calcutta, he still found it difficult to face the world and still spent much of his time alone in his room. For all his good qualities, David Priyaji had never been a strong character, Swale had concluded. And though he was now more or less recovered and doing a good job as General Secretary, far better than that rascal Jinnaratana could ever do, his little brush with the authorities had intensified his natural nervousness, and he did not always find it easy to get on with people. If ever I went down to Calcutta and met the man, I would see what he meant. Now that I was in Calcutta and discussing the projected biographical sketch with David Priyaji in the privacy of his room, I could indeed see what Swale had meant. But notwithstanding the little General Secretary's undoubted nervousness, which showed itself in his expression and demeanour rather than in the way in which he conducted the Society's affairs, the two of us got on quite well together, and though we never became friends, nonetheless succeeded in developing a good working relationship, a relationship that was to endure for a number of years. That we were able to develop such a relationship was due to the fact that while he was anxious for me to write a biographical sketch of Anagarika Dhammapala for inclusion in the Society's Diamond Jubilee souvenir, I was no less anxious to write such a sketch, as well as to the fact that as the work progressed, I came to share his admiration for the man with whom he had been so closely associated, from whom he had gradually taken over the running of the society, and whose spiritual heir he was generally considered to be. Not that the Anagarika's biography had not been written before. In the course of either our first or our second meeting, David Priyaji handed me the two bulky typewritten volumes which the Society had commissioned some years previously, but which it had found unsuitable for publication. Why it had found them unsuitable for publication soon became apparent. I had not read more than 2 or 3 chapters of the work before I realised that the perfervid Sinhalese author would much rather have written a pornographic novel than the biography of a prominent religious personality. for on the pretext of giving an account of the social and economic condition of Ceylon at the time of Dhammapala's birth. He had indulged in lengthy and highly detailed descriptions of the raping of black Tamil coolie women by lust-crazed white European tea planters. This was not at all the kind of material for which I was looking, though Devapriyaji was right in letting me see the volumes, since I was able to glean from them at least a handful of relevant facts. More germane to my purpose were certain other volumes that Devapriyaji handed me. Stout and blue-bound, these were 7 or 8 quartos of Dhammapala's personal diaries, extracts from which had been regularly appearing in the pages of the Mahabodhi for the past few years under the title Diary Leaves of the Late Anagarika Dhammapala. Venerable Dhammapala had kept a diary all his life, Devapriyaji informed me, and there were altogether more than 40 such stout, blue-bound quartos in existence. Unfortunately, only a small proportion were actually with him in Calcutta. The rest were in the keeping of the public trustee of Ceylon. If I liked, he would have write and ask that functionary to send them all to Calcutta for my perusal. Naturally, I did like, since I wanted my biographical sketch to be as reliable as possible, and Devapriyaji accordingly dispatched the necessary letter to Colombo without delay. For reasons which were never fully explained, but which were, I gathered, mainly of a legal nature, the public trustee was unable to send to Calcutta more than 10 or 12 inconsecutive volumes of the diaries, though a few, even of these, arrived too late to be of much use to me. Thus, in writing the life of Dhammapala, I had at my disposal upwards of 20 miscellaneous volumes of diaries, as well as being able to draw on the Anagarika's own book called Reminiscences of My Early Life, written shortly before his death, and on Devapriyaji's personal recollections of his master, not to mention such facts as I was able to glean from the bulky, unpublished volumes of the perfervid Sinhalese. Though by no means complete, the material was more than sufficient for my limited purpose. I had, after all, been asked to write a biographical sketch, not a full-length biography, and I lost no time in settling down to the agreeable task of reading and assimilating it all as quickly and as thoroughly as I could. Before many days had passed, I had established a basic routine not too dissimilar to that which I normally followed in Kaimpong. My day began at about 5, as, judging by the hawking and spitting noises that could be heard on all sides, most peoples did in Calcutta. At 6, one of the society's 2 Oriya servants, naked except for a white dhoti, swept my room out with a stiff reed broom, afterwards getting down on his knees and washing the floor with a rag which he dipped in a pail of filthy water. At 7, the same servant brought my breakfast, which consisted of a cup of lukewarm but very strong tea and 2 slices of thinly buttered toast. This was the society's standard breakfast, and it came not from the dark and insalubrious kitchen downstairs, but from a nearby tea shop. As soon as I had satisfied fleshly wants, and I had not, of course, eaten anything since noon the previous day, I barred my door against the world and settled down, not indeed like the hero of Betjeman's well-known poem, to Norman fonts, but to the bulky typewritten volumes of my Sinhalese predecessor, and the earliest of the stout blue-bound quartos of the Dhammapala diaries, and remained absorbed in them for the rest of the morning. Occasionally, when I felt stiff with sitting so long at my desk, or when I wanted to reflect on the information I had gathered, I strolled a few yards down the corridor and, resting my arms on the balustrade, looked out from the back veranda. Above me, there was only the intense blue of the unclouded autumn sky. Below, the gloomy well
formed by the first and second stories of the building and the high wall that closed off the remaining side of the square round which it was constructed. On the other side of the wall could be seen the red-tiled, crazily irregular roofs of a cluster of huts that had sprung up, quite illegally, during the war years, and which were occupied by no less than 70 Muslim families, some of whom were engaged in criminal activities of various kinds. So closely were these little huts packed together that, from above, the area seemed covered by a single undulous roof on which the sun blazed down as on the petrified waves of a crimson sea. Some years previously, the half acre or so of land on which the huts stood had been acquired by the Society for its proposed Institute of Buddhist Culture, and the Calcutta Corporation had undertaken to rehouse the occupants of the huts in one of its new colonies. So far, however, the corporation had done nothing, and in fact was to do nothing for quite a few more years. Had the land been acquired by any other organisation, the new owners would almost certainly have hired a gang of armed ruffians to drive out the unwanted tenants by force, as the Ramakrishna Mission had done in similar circumstances 5 years earlier, and that would have been the end of the matter. But the Mahabodhi Society was a Buddhist organisation, and Buddhism was committed to the principle of non-violence, so there is no question of its having recourse to methods of this kind, though I gathered that one or two Hindu members of the governing body were in favour of it so doing. Thus it was that, looking out from the back veranda, I could see below me the red-tiled roofage of the huts on the other side of the wall. I could also hear, rising and falling with monotonous regularity, the unearthly wail, more animal than human, of a madwoman who was confined in one of the back rooms of an adjoining building. The wail continued without intermission throughout the day and for part of the night, and if I listened carefully, I would hear it in my room even with the door closed. Who or what the woman was, I never discovered, but I heard that unearthly wail all day and every day for the whole of the 3 months that I stayed at the Society's headquarters. I also heard it on every one of my subsequent visits, so that, like the sight of the red-tiled roofage of the huts, the sound of the madwoman's wail came to be inseparably associated with my memories of Calcutta and of the Mahabodhi Society. At 11:30, I laid aside the volumes on which I had been working and went along to the bathroom cum latrine for a bath, taking good care to lock the door of my room behind me. The apartment in question, which was furnished with little more than a wall tap and a convenient hole in one corner, stank abominably, while the floor was not only red with rust from the bottom of the buckets with which, Indian style, one doused oneself, but so slippery as to constitute a definite hazard to life and limb. Accidents were, in fact, always taking place there. When I had had my bath, shaved and washed my robes by slapping and banging them on the floor in the approved fashion, I made my way downstairs to the dining room, a procedure which on some days felt more like making a descent into the infernal regions. According to the Theravada Vinaya, or monastic code, a monk could not eat after 12, but the monks of the Mahabodhi Society were not very strict in their observance of the Vinaya, and lunch, as it may be called, usually did not begin until a few minutes before the clock in the library upstairs struck the fatal hour, with the result that more often than not we were still eating 20 or even 30 minutes after the prescribed period. Since the barred windows of the dining room were kept shuttered for greater security, two bent bars bore witness to a recent attempt at breaking in, and since very little light entered by way of the door, the dining room was quite dark, such illumination as there was being provided mainly by the dusty electric bulb that hung from the centre of the ceiling, and shed a dim light on the table at which we sat. At that time, there were no more than 8 or 10 monks staying in the headquarters building, and since they did not foregather for either morning or evening puja, or, so far as I could make out, for any other purpose except to have lunch, it was only at lunchtime that I saw anything of them. Most of them were Sinhalese, and most were students at one or another of the city's educational institutions. The lay students who stayed in the building came and ate only after the monks had vacated the dining room, the Theravada condition that monks and laymen did not eat together being rigidly observed. Among the non-Sinhalese monks, there was one Bengali and one Newar. The Bengali monk was Venerable Sila Bhadra, the ex-Hindu lawyer who had become a Buddhist, and a monk quite late in life and who now helped David Priyaji edit the Mahabodhi, while the Newar was Venerable Mahanama, whom I'd last seen in Kathmandu and who was trying to get into Bengali films and had, in fact, already sent some very flattering photographs of himself, copies of which he showed us to various leading producers and directors. As for the food with which we were served, and which, at least in theory, constituted our one meal of the day, this consisted mainly of the same badly cooked rice and watery dal as in 1947, which was hardly surprising, since it was cooked and served by the same black, hairy figure in the soiled white loincloth, who had been in charge of the kitchen at that time, and who was, it seemed, a permanent inhabitant of the ground floor, along with the bedbugs and cockroaches. Venerable Dinaratana hardly ever ate in the dining room. On most days, however, he would come and sit with us for a while, crack a few jokes with the Sinhalese monks, wrinkle up his nose in disgust at the contents of our plates, scold Christo for not feeding us properly, and, if he was in a particularly good mood, send out for as many tiny earthenware pots of curd as there were monks in the dining room. Having gone through this little performance, he would go and have a leisurely massage and bath, and then retire into the privacy of his own room, a no less leisurely lunch, a lunch that would be brought from a nearby Muslim restaurant and usually consisted of a roast chicken. Since I had spent a night or two at the Society's headquarters several times during the last 2 years, and since Dinaratana and I had both been members of the delegation accompanying the sacred relics to Nepal, it was inevitable that after my higher ordination in November 1950, I should have met the self-styled high priest on a number of occasions. It was also inevitable that, now that we were in almost daily contact, the feeling of awkwardness existing between us on account of the fact that, 5 years ago, I had witnessed some rather unmonk-like behaviour on his part, an awkwardness that was still there at the time of my departure for Kathmandu the previous year, should at length be resolved, at least to some extent. At any rate, though Dinaratana did not exactly welcome me with open arms on my arrival at the Society's headquarters in my new character as Dharmapala's biographer, he at least made it clear, in his own abrupt and uncouth manner, that he was willing to let bygones be bygones, and henceforth to regard me as a friend rather than an enemy, or rather, since for him friendship was a matter of mutual self-interest, as an ally rather than as an adversary. The first sign of this willingness came only a day or two after my arrival, and before I had established my routine. 4 or 5 monks, including Dinaratana and myself, had been invited to the house of a wealthy supporter of the society for a ceremonial food offering, and we had arranged to meet at the front of the building. As soon as I appeared, Dinaratana's eyes opened wide in astonishment. "Why are you wearing that shabby, patched old robe?" he demanded. "What on earth will people think of us?"
In vain I protested that I had nothing better to wear, and that, in any case, a shabby patched robe was the best kind of robe for one who had given up the world and was technically a beggar. Why, the Buddha himself had worn just such a robe as this. But Jinaratana refused to listen. Seizing me by the arm, he hurried me upstairs to his room, where he presented me with a brand new cotton robe of the Sinhalese type, buttercup yellow in colour, and made me put it on. He himself, needless to say, was swathed in a magnificent robe of the finest yellow silk, and what with his bright new sandals and his polished scalp, not to mention his commanding air, he looked the very model of a modern high priest. In this he was not unrepresentative of the branch of the monastic order to which he belonged, and it was not surprising that, writing 3 or 4 years later, I should have criticised the Hinayana for over-attachment to the formal aspects of monasticism, or that in giving specific examples of such formalism, I should have alluded to the fact that, quote, a Theravada monk's outfit, technically the badge of poverty, can be 4 or 5 times as costly as that of a middle-class layman, end quote. At the time, however, I kept these thoughts to myself, and having exchanged my shabby patched old robe for the brand new one, which, in Jinaratana's opinion, was less likely to bring discredit on the monastic order, I followed the glittering figure of my benefactor downstairs to the waiting taxi without a word. But though I was relieved that Jinaratana was, as it seemed, willing to let bygones be bygones and to regard me as a friend rather than as an enemy, I felt I was entitled to let bygones be bygones only on my own behalf, that is, only in respect of my own past treatment at his hands, which in any case had not been so very bad. I was certainly not entitled to let bygones be bygones on behalf of other people, particularly insofar as his inhuman treatment of the aged and helpless Miss Albers was concerned. Treatment I had witnessed with my own eyes, and about which I had written a strongly worded letter of protest to David Priya Vallisinna, who was at that time in Ceylon, and whom I had not, of course, met. Moreover, even if the gift of the robe really was a sign of Jinaratana's willingness to let bygones be bygones, I could not ignore the fact that the immediate cause of his generosity was his fear of what people might think of Buddhist monks if one of their number was seen wearing a robe that was old, shabby and patched. Thus, the very gesture that was intended to demonstrate his willingness to regard me as a friend only served to show how great was the gulf that divided us and how little likelihood there was that anything remotely resembling friendship should ever exist between us. Our values were completely different, even opposed. Nevertheless, since we were living under the same roof and meeting almost every day, even if only at lunchtime, I resolved that, though I could not in honesty regard him as a friend, I would at least try not to think of him as an enemy, and that those aspects of his behaviour which I was unable to condone, and there were some which filled me with unspeakable disgust, I at any rate would refrain from condemning. For the time being, at least, though I could not be cordial, I could be correct. Let him follow his way of life, and let me follow mine. There was no need for us to clash or quarrel. At lunch, therefore, I tried to keep what was afterwards called a low profile, which, since conversation was mainly in Sinhalese, I did not find very difficult. If Jinaratana jibed at me for my abstention from meat, for Sinhalese pilgrims would sometimes offer us fish and mutton dishes, I did my best to make light of my vegetarianism. Or if he made an indecent joke, I either affected that I had not heard or that I had not understood. In this way, peace was preserved, much of the awkwardness between us resolved, and the beginnings of something like good relations established. When he had sat with us for a while and had gone through his little performance, Dinaratna could therefore go and have his leisurely massage and bath, and his no less leisurely lunch, without anything having occurred to spoil his appetite, while I could return to my room, relieved that another meal had passed without incident, and that I was free to get on with my task of reading and assimilating the materials for my biographical sketch. Not that I always got on with it immediately, however. Though Calcutta was not particularly hot at that time of year, it was hot and humid enough, and even though I did not sleep during the afternoon as everybody else in the building seemed to do, from humble Aurea servant to lordly high priest, I usually lay down on my bed for a while, more often than not with a volume of English poetry in my hand. When sufficiently rested, I rose, washed my face, and settled down once more to the bulky typewritten volumes and stout blue-bound quartos that were now my constant companions, pausing only to go out onto the back veranda at about 4 or 5 o'clock, and, leaning as far out over the balustrade as I could, shout down into the well of the building for one of the servants to go and get me a cup of tea from the nearby tea shop. At 7 or 8, I went out for a walk. By this time, it would be quite dark, but not so dark that one could not see and smell the dense haze that was rising from the innumerable kitchens where fish was being fried in mustard oil, a haze that by 9 or 10 hung over the city like a pall and was at times so pungent as to make one's eyes water. Sometimes I walked round the tiny park in the middle of College Square, in one corner of which a game of volleyball would be in progress under the dim electric lights, and where the cracked marble statues of bygone civic dignitaries rose white and solemn out of the shadows, some of them wearing Bengali dress and sitting with legs folded beneath enormous paunches at the top of crumbling pedestals, faintly inscribed with their names, titles, qualifications and achievements. Sometimes, emerging from the park and crossing over onto the other side of College Street, I made my way along the row of second-hand bookstalls that, from 6 or 7 in the evening until nearly midnight, displayed their wares on the railings in front of the Senate House. Here paraffin flares were the only illumination, so that it was not always easy to make out the titles of the books offered for sale. Most of them were, of course, in Bengali, but many were in English, with school and college textbooks predominating, though at one time or another I was able to pick up such bargains as the Bonn edition of the works of Sir Thomas Browne and an obscure American translation of Plotinus. At the time that I was preparing to write my biographical sketch of Dharmapala, however, and indeed for quite a few years afterwards, I had very little money to spare for books, so that I was, perforce, more often a browser than a buyer. Only occasionally did I return to the Society's headquarters with a slim volume of poetry or literary criticism that, to my great delight, I had succeeded in obtaining for a rupee or less. When that happened, I usually stayed up quite late, devouring as much of my new acquisition as I could before sleep finally overpowered me. Thus the warm autumn days passed quickly and pleasantly enough, and I felt less and less inclined to interrupt the routine I had established. Indeed, I interrupted it only when David Priyaji invited me to his room for a cup of tea and a chat, which he did every 2 or 3 days, usually after his breakfast or lunch. On these occasions, taking advantage of my opportunity, I would ask him to clarify anything of an obscure or controversial nature relating to the life and times of Dharmapala that I had come across in the material he had so far handed me, and also encourage him to give me his personal recollections of the great Anagarika, who had now been dead for more than 20 years. In the course of our fourth or fifth such meeting, however, the little General Secretary nervously opined that my preparations for writing the biographical sketch were taking far too long, especially in view of the fact that it did not have to be longer than 10,000 words in length, and that the sooner I got down to the business of actual composition, the better. By this time it was late September or early October, and knowing that the Diamond Jubilee souvenir had to be out by the end of November, and that the biographical sketch had to be not only written and typed, but seen through the press, I had no choice but to agree. I therefore assured David Preogee, much to his relief, that I would start straight away and begin writing the first half of Dhammapada's life before I had finished going through the material relating to the second. This was not the most satisfactory arrangement, and probably a professional biographer would not have approved of it, but it was the only one that would enable the Diamond Jubilee souvenir to be brought out on time. And since this was the main consideration, I adopted it without hesitation. Next morning I set to work. Quote, "The prospects of Ceylon Buddhism in the 60s of the last century were dark indeed," I wrote. Successive waves of Portuguese, Dutch and British invasion had swept away much of the traditional culture of the country. Missionaries had descended on the copper-coloured island like a cloud of locusts. Christian schools of every conceivable denomination had been opened, where Buddhist boys and girls were crammed with Bible texts and taught to be ashamed of their religion, their culture, their language, their race and their colour. Having continued in this vein for a couple of pages and painted a black picture of the religious situation in Ceylon at the time of Dhammapada's birth, I went on to describe the pious, well-to-do family into which he had been born, his early ethical and religious training, his education in various Christian institutions, and his growing awareness of the contradictions within Christianity and the extent of the difference between Christianity and Buddhism. Before many days had passed, I was completely immersed in my subject and lived, thought and felt Dhammapala, or Don David Hewavitan, as he was known during the earlier part of his life. Practically all my waking hours were spent either writing or reading about him, and I grudged even the time I had to spend eating. To such an extent did I identify with him, indeed, especially after he had passed from childhood to adolescence, that it was as though I was myself actually present with him throughout his career and witnessed each episode in his life as it occurred. I was with him when he met the founders of the Theosophical Society, with him when he accompanied Madame Blavatsky to Adyar and was told by her to study Pali and work for the good of humanity, with him when he toured the villages of Ceylon with Colonel Olcott, with him when he visited Japan, with him when he went on pilgrimage to India. Above all, perhaps, I was with him when, in January 1891, he visited Buddha Gaya and, quote, "received the inspiration that was to change not only his whole life, but the whole course of modern Buddhist history," end quote. The inspiration to stay and care for the sacred spot, then in a shamefully neglected condition. Thereafter I was with him when he founded the Mahabodhi Society, when he visited England and America, when he attended the World's Parliament of Religions in Chicago, when he met Mrs. Mary E. Foster, the most munificent of his supporters, when he visited the Far East, when he went on an extended tour of North India, when he battled for possession of Buddha Gaya, when he sought to reawaken the national spirit among his Sinhalese fellow countrymen, when he was interned in Calcutta, when he built the Sri Dhammarajika Chaitya Vihara, and the Mula Gandakuti Vihara when he started a Buddhist mission in London, when he took first lower and then higher ordination as a monk. I was with him in the East and in the West, in youth and in old age, in his dreams and in his meditations, in success and in failure, in health and in sickness. Finally, when I had been writing for 3 weeks and had produced well over twice the number of words required, I was with him at the very last stage of all, when, as the assembled monks recited verses from the sacred texts, quote, "The great being's consciousness, radiant with a lifetime of wisdom, energy and love, relaxed its hold on the worn-out body and flashed into new realms of service, leaving upon the face of the corpse it had forsaken a serene smile of happiness and content." End of quote. When I had written those words, the concluding words of my biographical sketch, I sat for a while, quote, "like one that hath been stunned and is of sense forlorn." For 3 weeks I had not only been with Dhammapala, so to speak, but been with him throughout the whole of his latest earthly existence. And now that he was no more, I experienced a profound sense of bereavement. I felt, in fact, as though I had lost a friend. The reason I felt like this was that, in the course of writing my biographical sketch, I had not only accumulated a good deal of information about the very extensive activities of the founder of the Mahabodhi Society and reviver of Buddhism in India, as he was generally styled in the society's publications. I had also got to know the man himself. I had discovered Dhammapala. Nor was that all. The Dhammapala I had discovered, the Dhammapala who revealed himself so vividly in the pages of the diaries, had turned out to be a very different kind of person from the Dhammapala hitherto known to me, and very different, I suspected, from the Dhammapala known to the vast majority of the society's members and supporters. Far from being an activist and organiser in the more superficial, even slightly pejorative sense, he was an idealist and a man of vision, a man of intense inner life who, from boyhood onwards, had been strongly inclined towards mysticism and asceticism, and was always on the lookout for news about arahants and the science of abhijna, or supernormal knowledge. Even though, as he himself wrote in his reminiscences, the bhikshus of Ceylon were sceptical about the possibility of realising arahantship, believing that the age of arahants was past, and that the realisation of nirvana by psychic training was no longer possible. Had circumstances been different, Dhammapala might well have spent his days not battling for Buddhagaya and trying to revive Buddhism in India, or even, quote, "girdling the globe with the message of the master," unquote, but meditating in a cave or forest hermitage somewhere in his beloved Ceylon. As it was, he grew up to be the most active and widely travelled Buddhist of his generation, so active and so widely travelled indeed, that it was all too easy for one to see in him only the activist and organiser, overlooking the fact that, quote, "beneath the dynamic activity of the selfless worker for Buddhism, there lay the serenity and mindfulness of the yogi," unquote. It was all too easy for one to miss the Dhammapala who, during those memorable weeks, I had had the good fortune to discover, and who was now the object of my fervent admiration. The discovery of Dhammapala naturally led to the discovery of the Mahabodhi Society. My sojourn at the Society's headquarters in 1947 had, of course, left me with an extremely unfavourable impression of that organisation, and until I started going through the material David Priyaji had handed me, until, more especially, I started writing my biographical sketch, little or nothing had occurred to modify that initial impression, or to make me wish for a closer connection with the society. On the contrary, I had wanted to have as little to do with it as possible. Now, however, I could see that the Mahabodhi Society as it existed today was a very different kind of organisation from the Mahabodhi Society as it had existed during Dhammapala's lifetime. Then it had been an organisation imbued with its founder's own idealism, his own spirit of self-sacrifice, so that it had been able to live up to its declared objects and to function as a medium for the dissemination of the Dharma. I could also see that since the Mahabodhi Society was, in principle, no more simply an organisation in the negative sense of the term than Dhammapala himself had been merely an activist and organiser, it was always possible for it to change and be what it had once been. Perhaps the change had started taking place already. On my arrival at the headquarters building, I had noticed that, though outwardly the place had not changed at all in 5 years, a very different kind of atmosphere prevailed. And having now lived and worked there for 2 whole months, I was convinced that the difference was due largely to the presence of Deva Priyaji. Though a lesser man than Dhammapala in every way, he had been closely associated with the Anagarika for 16 years, and on the latter's death had become not only General Secretary for life, but, what was even more important, quote, the inheritor of his master's unfulfilled ambitions, and the chief instrument for the perpetuation of the work and ideals to which he had dedicated his life, end of quote. Deva Priyaji thus stood for the Mahabodhi Society as it had been in its founder's lifetime, and therefore for the Mahabodhi Society as it could be again, even as Jinnaratana stood for the Mahabodhi Society as it had come to be in more recent times. Deva Priyaji stood for what the Mahabodhi Society was in principle, Jinnaratana for what, in the absence of proper leadership, it was possible for it to degenerate into. I therefore decided that I would do whatever I could to help Deva Priyaji in this way contribute, at least indirectly, to the restoration of the society to a condition more appropriate to a Buddhist organisation, and therefore more in accordance with its founder's intentions. Deva Priyaji was certainly in need of help just then. Besides carrying on with his routine duties as General Secretary, he was busy organising the Society's forthcoming Diamond Jubilee celebrations, a task that included the bringing out of the Diamond Jubilee souvenir. He was also busy making arrangements for the re-enshrinement of the sacred relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Maha Modgalyayana in their new vihara at Sanchi. Since Sanchi was situated near Bhopal, and since Bhopal was more than 600 miles distant from Calcutta, the making of these arrangements involved an enormous amount of correspondence, the more especially as Pandit Nehru was expected to attend the function, together with a host of other dignitaries, both Indian and foreign, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, monk and lay. So great was the amount of correspondence involved, indeed, that the clatter of Deva Priyaji's typewriter could often be heard quite late at night, while there would be a light coming from beneath his door into the early hours of the morning. I was therefore not surprised when the little General Secretary asked me if I would mind taking over from him the responsibility for seeing the Diamond Jubilee souvenir through the press and making sure that it was out on time. He himself, he added, would always be available for consultation. I certainly did not mind taking over the responsibility. In fact, I was delighted to be of use, and spent the next few weeks checking galleys and page proofs, searching through old blocks for illustrations. There was no money for new ones. Consulting with the young Bengali artist who was designing the cover, and somehow finding room for articles and messages that arrived late. Since the souvenir eventually came to more than 200 quarto pages, and since page proofs generally had to be read 3 or 4 times, all this involved more work than I had expected. But at last it was all done, and a few days before the end of November, David Priyaji and I had the satisfaction of holding the olive and chocolate-coloured volume in our hands. David Priyaji was relieved that the souvenir had been brought out in good time, and pleased that a proper account of the life and work of Dharmapala and the achievements of the society he had founded should at last be available. I was overjoyed that I had discovered Dharmapala, overjoyed that I had been able to share my discovery with others, and glad to see my first substantial piece of Buddhist writing in print. As was only fitting, Anagarika Dharmapala, a biographical sketch, to give my contribution its full title, and the Mahabodhi Society, its history and influence. Between them occupied the entire first half of a souvenir, exclusive of introductory matter. The latter article was the work of Dr. Nalilaksha Dutt, head of the Department of Pali at the University of Calcutta, whose scholarly aspects of Mahayana Buddhism in its relation to the Hinayana I had long known and valued. Among the other contributions to the volume were articles on Buddhist history and culture by some of the leading Bengali savants of the day, as well as an article on Mrs. Mary E. Foster, Queen of the Empire of Righteousness, as Dharmapala himself had called her, which I had written almost immediately after completing my biographical sketch of the Anagarika. Without Mrs. Foster's unparalleled generosity, Dharmapala would not have been able to achieve more than a fraction of what he actually did achieve. Even before her death, he had directed that her birthday should be celebrated at all centres of the Mahabodhi Society, and I therefore felt that, without a tribute to the memory of the great-hearted Hawaiian lady, the Diamond Jubilee souvenir of the Society, which she had done so much to help, would not be complete. Be that as it may, on its first appearance towards the end of November, only a few days before the sacred relics were due to leave for Sanchi, the Diamond Jubilee souvenir met with a very warm reception, both inside and outside the society, my biographical sketch of Dharmapala being singled out for special praise. From some of the comments that reached me, I indeed gained the impression that most members and supporters of the society knew very little more about Dharmapala than I myself had known 3 months earlier, and that they were glad to have the man behind the activist and organiser brought to life for them. There was only one dissonant voice amidst the chorus of praise, but the sound of that voice did not actually reach me until some time afterwards. Had it not been for an incident that occurred while I was still checking page proofs, there might, however, have been a few more such voices, and their united sound might have reached me rather more quickly. Proofs were supposed to be delivered to me direct, so that I could set to work on them without delay. Sometimes, however, the printer's devil simply left them on David Priyaji's desk in the general office downstairs, that particular desk being conveniently situated just inside the front door. If David Priyaji happened to be in the office at the time, he would send the proofs straight up to me by one of the servants. Otherwise, they might lie on his desk for hours. When too many hours had passed since the delivery of the last batch of proofs, therefore, I used to go downstairs to see if there were any lying on David Priyaji's desk. On one such occasion, I entered the general office to find the tall, safari-suited figure of Mr. Sitaram, a South Indian member of the governing body, standing at the empty desk with an expression of apparent disinterest on his dark face. In his hands was a batch of page proofs, through which he was idly leafing, as it seemed, while waiting for David Priyaji to arrive. Before I could take the proofs from him, however, his whole frame suddenly stiffened, and his face became purple with rage, while his eyes remained riveted to one particular page, as though unable to believe what they saw. "This can't be published," he roared, stabbing at the offending passage with a black forefinger. "It's an insult to the memory of Swami Vivekananda. It's a foul slander. I shall complain to the governing body." At this point, David Priyaji arrived, having been out for his evening walk, and there ensued a three-cornered wrangle, in the course of which the incensed South Indian had a great deal to say, David Priyaji quite a lot, and myself very little. The truth was that I'd been taken aback by the violence of Sitaram's outburst, and was at first at a loss to understand why he was so upset, or in what way I had insulted the memory of Swami Vivekananda. But I soon understood. Describing Dhammapala's return journey from Japan to Ceylon in 1889, I had referred to an incident which showed how faithful he was to his friends. The captain of the ship on which he was travelling happened to be a great admirer of Madame Blavatsky, and Dhammapala was therefore soon on friendly terms with him. But when the captain confided that Colonel Olcott was jealous of her and had engineered her departure from India, the young Dhammapala hotly repudiated the suggestion and hardly spoke to the man again for the rest of the voyage. Quote, "His loyal, affectionate, and grateful nature would never bear in silence an attack upon a friend," I had written, commenting on the incident. And at this period especially, devotion to the colonel was one of the major passions of his life. Unquote. Enlarging on the theme, I had then gone on to describe how a few years later, on his return from the World's Parliament of Religions, Dhammapala spoke publicly in defence of Swami Vivekananda, when the latter was charged with having taken alcoholic liquors while in America. And when the citizens of Calcutta, scandalised by this departure from strict Hindu orthodoxy, were minded not to give him a reception on his arrival in the metropolis. So vigorously did Dhammapala speak in defence of Vivekananda, not in defence of his taking alcohol, of course, but of his whole heroic work in America, that the cyclonic Hindu monk, as the Americans had dubbed him, was at once restored to popular favour. As in the case of the earlier incident with the ship's captain, my purpose in referring to these facts had been simply to illustrate Dhammapala's intense loyalty to his friends. He and Vivekananda had known each other in America, and thus to draw attention to an important aspect of his character. But Sitaram absolutely refused to see the matter in this light. "Swami Vivekananda was a perfect monk," he stormed. "He was a saint. He was a Jivan Mukta, one who had obtained liberation in this very life. It was therefore utterly impossible that he should have taken alcohol, whether in America or anywhere else, and to suggest that he had ever done so would be nothing less than a foul slander." In vain David Priyaji protested that Dhammapala had more than once seen Vivekananda drinking wine at dinner parties and had recorded the fact in his diary. Sitaram refused to listen and eventually stalked out of the general office, declaring that, unless the offending passage was removed from the biographical sketch, he would raise the matter at the next meeting of the governing body. As he left the building, I could not help wondering how he would have responded if David Pierji had told him that, as the diaries also revealed, Dhammapala had seen Vivekananda tipsy, and that the cyclonic Hindu monk had wanted to marry an American woman with whom he had fallen in love, and that his disciples had had to persuade him to give up the idea. No doubt he would have stormed that these two were foul slanders, and it was utterly impossible that his hero should ever have been tipsy or should ever have fallen in love with a woman, especially an American woman. So obviously irrational was Sitaram's whole attitude, indeed, that despite the violence of his initial outburst, I at first assumed that there could be no question of my having to remove the reference to Vivekananda taking alcoholic liquors. But the following morning, over our usual pot of tea, David Priyaji regretfully disillusioned me. Sitaram was not a bad man, he explained. In some ways he was a very good man. But he was a staunch Hindu and had been genuinely shocked by my reference to Vivekananda taking alcoholic liquors, true though it was. If I refused to remove the offending passage, he would certainly complain to the governing body, and the governing body would certainly take the same view of the matter as Sitaram, since the majority of its members were Hindus, and were, moreover, active supporters of the Ramakrishna mission, which Vivekananda had founded. If I persisted in my refusal, they might not allow the biographical sketch to be published at all, which would be a great pity. He therefore advised me, he continued, to remove the offending passage. After all, it was only a question of changing a few words. Before Sitaram had a chance to complain to the governing body, and in this way save myself a lot of unnecessary trouble. Though pained by the idea that the life of a prominent Buddhist, written by a Buddhist monk and due for publication by a Buddhist organisation, should be subjected to what amounted to pre-censorship by a staunch Hindu, I could see that David Priyaji's advice made sense and in the end reluctantly agreed to make the necessary sacrifice. Drastically shortening the passage concerned, I therefore described Dhammapala as defending Vivekananda not when the latter was charged with having taken alcoholic liquors while in America, but simply when, quote, serious charges, unquote, were made against him in Calcutta. Strange to relate, when the amended passage was shown to Sitaram, he approved it at once. Personally, I would have thought that if it was objectionable to say of someone that he had been charged with taking alcoholic liquors, it was at least as objectionable to say of him that serious charges had been made against him. The charge of taking alcohol related to the commission of a single specified offence, possibly not a very serious one at that, whereas serious charges could refer to all manner of offences from murder to bank robbery. But Sitaram did not see this. His sole concern was that in my biographical sketch of Dhammapala, there should be no reference to Vivekananda taking alcoholic liquors. And once the words which, to him, represented the Swami actually committing this heinous offence had been removed, he was satisfied. Thus, in the end, my sacrifice was not a very big one. The changes I was forced to make did not really alter the meaning of what I had written to any material extent, even though without those changes there might have been, amid the chorus of praise with which my contribution to the Diamond Jubilee souvenir was soon to be greeted, a few more dissonant voices than there actually were. All the same, I found the incident that had taken place in the General Office and its sequel deeply disturbing. Besides showing how indifferent to considerations of objective truth an English-educated Hindu could be, it showed that, although under the terms of Dhammapala's will, David Priyaji was General Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society for Life, he was not in a position, or perhaps did not have the strength of character, to go against the wishes of the governing body. It also showed that the governing body was a predominantly Hindu body, and that the affairs of the premier Buddhist organization of India were, therefore, effectively in the hands of people who are not really committed to the ideals of Buddhism. Above all, perhaps, it showed that, despite the fact that Devaprayaji had now been back in Calcutta for 3 or 4 years, the society still had a long way to go before it could be regarded as fulfilling the objects with which it had been established by the Dhammapala I had recently discovered. The Dhammapala who, I hoped, I had caused to live once more in the pages of my biographical sketch. Footnote. This article has now been combined with other relevant material and is available online under the title Flame in Darkness. End of chapter 18.